The Green Front with Betsy Rosenberg, Wednesdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to today's edition of The Green Front. I'm your host, Betsy Rosenberg, particularly excited to bring you today's guest. First up, Mike Tidwell. He is the founder and director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network and a wonderful activist and author and recently a columnist who has gotten my attention again. He's been a guest on the show before, and pleased to have him back, especially in light of his last couple of columns, which he wrote just before the triple hit disaster in Japan, and considering that one of the columns is called The Sky Really Is Falling, and that was written about 3 weeks before the monster earthquake and horrific tsunami followed by the nuclear partial meltdown, the drama which is still unfolding. Want to get his thoughts now. And then just when we get ourselves pretty worked up and frightened and alarmed, and we're not talking alarmed in any dramatic, overly dramatic sense, we're talking about the realistic events that are unfolding right around us if we only open our eyes and ears and connect the dots, which some of us can't help but do, then we're going to turn to hope. Not that Mike Tidwell is without hope. I think the definition of environmentalists is people who get up every day hoping to make the world a better place. Otherwise, why would we bother trying? Wilford Welch is a former U.S. diplomat. He has written a book called The Tactics of Hope, How Social Entrepreneurs Are Changing Our World. He is obsessed with sustainability, and that's a very healthy obsession in my view. So because we have so much to talk about, I'm not going to waste any more time chatting other than to mention some positive news. Always like to start out with the good news. A couple of weeks ago, I had State Senator Joe Simidian on. He is from the very progressive Green Bay area where I not only live but grew up, and he had passed along legislation to our very green Governor Brown, Jerry Brown, a mandate, a law that would require California, the golden green state, to get 33% of our electricity from renewable sources, and that was signed into law by Governor Moonbeam. Maybe we should call him Governor Sunshine now. So that is very good news for all of those waiting for legislation, waiting for signals from our government, if not federal, then at the state level, to go ahead and start gearing up, ramping up any kind of solar, wind projects that we can possibly, create. So that's great news. Just wanted to follow up with that positive note. And now let's go to Mike Tidwell. Thanks for joining me, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
Well, if anyone has not heard of Mike Tidwell, I will just tell you that he is maybe not a fortune teller, but he predicted the disaster that we all know came to the Louisiana coast with Hurricane Katrina. He wrote a book back in 2003 that was The Rich Life and Tragic Death of Louisiana's Cajun Coast, and his newest book focusing on Katrina and global warming is called The Ravaging Tide, Strange Weather, Future Katrinas, and the Coming Death of America's Coastal Cities. He's also done a documentary film that I have not yet seen but looking forward to called We Are All Smith Islanders, which vividly depicts the dangers of climate change in Maryland, Virginia, and D.C., where you hail from, Mike. And speaking of hail and snow and sleet, let's just talk about the weather that we've seen over the last couple of months, which prompted your first column back on Valentine's Day. While some people were thinking about hearts, you had other things in mind with the green glasses always on. You wrote a column called The Sky Really Is Falling. It was in the Baltimore Sun, I believe. And you talked about the wacky weather as more evidence that Mother Nature is screaming at us. And then that was followed a couple weeks later by a column you wrote in the Washington Post, A Climate Change Activist Prepares for the Worst, talking about recent actions you took, which some might consider pretty radical. We'll talk about those. And then all of that was just before we saw the disaster unfold in Japan. So I thought of you immediately because there's all kinds of reasons to be concerned about what's going on in the world. In fact, Newsweek magazine last week on their cover, I don't know if you saw it, but it reminded me of you. It says, apocalypse now, tsunamis, earthquakes, nuclear meltdowns, revolutions, economies on the brink, what the bleep is next, and that one didn't even mention climate change. So thanks for joining me on the Green Front, Mike. What are your thoughts these days?
Well, again, thanks for having me. Well, I spend a lot of time, I've been a full-time climate activist for 10 years, and I think the first 8 of those years, starting in 2001, so during the early 2000s, you know, I spent a lot of time, you know, talking to people and writing about the impacts of climate change that were forecast to come down the road. You know, if we do nothing now, we're going to see extreme weather. We're going to see unrecognizable weather patterns and droughts and floods and sea level rise. But for the last 2 years, really, I've focused more on trying to get people to see that our weather is already unrecognizable, that if we just pause and try to connect the dots, that people, wherever they live, wherever it is, whether it's Japan or southern India or China or Washington,
how about Wisconsin
D.C.
this week, where they had twisters and tornadoes that they've never had, just flattening towns?
Yeah, I mean, wherever you are, it's too hot, too cold, too wet, too dry. No, there is no normal.
Texas is having a horrendous drought. Texas, where President Bush is retired. I wonder if he's connecting the dots yet, you think?
Maybe not, but I know a lot of people in D.C. where I live, I think it's ironic that the capital of America, the world's biggest carbon polluter as a nation, America, the capital of D.C., our weather in the last year and a half has just been totally unrecognizable. Last winter, we shattered every record for snow accumulation. I mean, more snow than had ever fallen in, you know, 140 years of record keeping. And a lot of people, you know, who are climate deniers say, oh, snowfall, see, there's no global warming. No, the reality is we didn't come close to setting records for low temperatures. We set records for frozen precipitation, which makes sense because as you warm the planet, more ocean water evaporates into the atmosphere, and what goes up must come down. So we're seeing more extreme precipitation even during the winter. So we shattered all the records for snowfall in D.C., followed by what? The hottest summer last summer in the record in the history of D.C. By far. I mean, much warmer than any summer we've ever had. And then we've had year-round thunderstorms that have been knocking out power in the District of Columbia more than anyone can ever remember. And that's just here. And then, of course, you go to Texas, you go to Australia, Pakistan. So the extreme weather in ways precisely similar to what scientists say we should expect under global warming is already here. And we have to get people to understand it's a right here, right now issue, and therefore it's a right here, right now solution that we need to reach for.
And yet, after that huge, snowpocalypse fell on, I think it was New York City right after Christmas, Sean Hannity had me on his television show along with Chris Horner, the great anti-environmentalist. I call him the deniosaur. They very arrogantly, you know, mocked me and my ilk. You would have been in there too. Global warming, what global warming? The snow is piling up. And they're so damn arrogant. And this is, you know, just a few months ago. What will it take, Mike?
It's a great question. It's unclear what it will take to get the hardcore climate deniers to address the issue. You know, a lot of us thought that Hurricane Katrina would have been a transformative event. It turns out it wasn't. Many of us thought the heat wave in Europe in 2003, where 30,000 people died, would be enough. But it turns out that human beings traditionally have to learn big truths the hard way, you know, and, you know, one world war wasn't enough to sell Europe on peace. It took two, but this seems to have gotten the job done. So, you know, the bad news is apparently we have to go through more impacts. We have to suffer more from climate impacts. But the good news is that in the United States in particular, you know, Winston Churchill said, Americans can always spend it on to do the right thing after exhausting all other possibilities. You know, and I think we're close in America to exhausting all the other possibilities. I mean, oil, gasoline is racing toward $4 a barrel with unrest in the Middle East. We have the nuclear issue, you know, warnings from Japan, et cetera. It's time. We're very close to exhausting all the other possibilities. And I think when we change, we will change explosively. That tends to be how we change in America. It takes us a long time to end slavery, but when we do it, we do it abruptly. You know, women's rights, civil rights, you name it. So there's hope for us, but the problem with climate change is if you wait too long, then you cross thresholds and maybe there's, you know, we lose our ability to affect our life-giving climate.
And the other quote from Winston Churchill, of course, is the era of procrastination, of half measures, of soothing and baffling expedients, of delays is coming to its close. In its place, we are entering a period of consequences. He said that on the eve of World War II. We certainly are in the period of climate consequences right now. And so you've taken some pretty drastic measures in your column February 24th. You say you're preparing for the worst. Yes, you've got solar panels and a garden and all that, but now you have a gun and a garden in your basement and deadbolt locks on your doors. What happened to make you, and this was all before, again, the perfect storm that we saw and still see unfolding in Japan just weeks before?
Well, 10 years ago when I first got very concerned about climate change, having read, you know, all of Bill McKibben's works and the newest science coming out in 2001, I decided I had to get very, very active on this issue. And one of the first things I did was solarize my roof, solar electricity, solar hot water. I even started heating my home with organically fertilized corn kernels and a corn-burning stove, became a vegetarian, made lots of changes in my life. But this last summer, after the power in my house, and I live right outside of the District of Columbia, the district begins at the end of my block. I live in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Our power has gone out so many times in my neighborhood in the last year and a half, but especially in the last 6 months due to extreme wind, extreme rain, unrecognizable thunderstorms year-round, that I decided to get a backup power generator, a gasoline power generator, so that, you know, my family would have some power as the electricity continues to fail and my solar panels can't keep up. So I did that, and then at the same time, I couldn't help but notice, you know, global food riots. You know, look, a lot of the unrest in the Mideast actually began as riots over food in Tunisia, in Egypt. Rising food costs have been a big part of that social unrest, not only in the Middle East but around the world. Why? Because Russia last year stopped exporting wheat because of the extreme drought and wildfires decimated its wheat crop. Australia pretty much is no longer a wheat exporter because of permanent drought triggered and conforming to the characteristics of climate change. So at the same time that I was buying a gas generator last summer because my electricity kept going out in the nation's capital due to extreme wind and rain, I also was very aware of the fact that if this keeps up, we're going to have food insecurity, not just in the Middle East, but all over the world, including in the United States. And I couldn't help but notice that the locks on all my doors in my 100-year-old house were about 100 years old themselves, these old rickety locks, and maybe it's time to, you know, get some better security in my neighborhood and in my house. So I replaced all the locks again, consciously concerned about the social unrest already here and inevitably about to accelerate with climate change, even in the United States. So I made the conscious decision to get better locks. I don't think I'm paranoid. I go to church every Sunday. I coach a little league baseball team. I have a 401k retirement account. I'm not a paranoid whack job. But, you know, I see the trees falling all around my house. I see the power going out. I see the food prices going up. And I don't own a gun. I don't. I'm a pacifist, you know. But at the same time, I did recently take a lesson in skeet shooting and how to handle a shotgun. I don't intend to buy a gun immediately, but, you know, is it crazy at some point down the road, if the worst really does happen, to want to be able to fully protect your own family? You know, I don't know. These are the issues that I'm wrestling with right now. You know, I've done everything I can in my life to raise awareness about global warming. I put solar panels up before solar was cool. I spend every day of my life writing and speaking about solutions and wind farms and all the rest. But there comes a point when a climate activist, you know, when you become a climate activist, you're basically taking responsibility for all people everywhere, whether they know it or not. And not just
and whether,
all people,
whether you choose to do it or not. Once we know too much, we're kind of blessed and cursed, aren't we?
Yeah, and you take responsibility for everybody and all living things, and not just now but in the future. That's an awesome responsibility to bear. But there comes a point, I think, if it gets bad enough, where you have to begin to shift and really take responsibility for those closest to you that you love the most. And that's the interesting dynamic. I've been out there shouldering responsibility for all people everywhere in the world, and I still do that because I'm trying to stop global climate change. I'm not just trying to protect my 13-year-old, but to protect all kids everywhere. But there also comes a point where you have to ask yourself, is the worst going to happen? Is there too much warming in the bank? What are my responsibilities as a responsible parent to my child? Maybe I should replace those locks. Maybe I do need the backup generator. So that was the nature of the essay that I wrote in the Washington Post on February 27th, and it was meant to provoke. It was meant to push people outside their comfort zone. It pushed me outside my comfort zone as a writer to have to admit, to confess that I've gotten a gas generator. Mr. Hope, Mr. Gleaming Hopeful Solar Panel activist Mike Tidwell has got a backup generator and put new locks on his door. And so my hope was that that reality, that confession, that painful truth would be enough to get people to pull them out of their denial, to connect the dots about the extreme unrecognizable weather in D.C. and all over the world, and begin to push harder for the solutions that are still within our grasp.
And your experience as an environmentalist, as a climate activist, can be repeated. I mean, you are one of the, you know, great Cassandras out there, and you have been working so hard, and you did predict Katrina, and your view covers such a, you know, wide bit of the major problems we're facing, from coastal erosion to climate change to just what's going on in Chesapeake Bay alone with pollution. So I applaud you. I respect you. You definitely shook me up when I read those columns, because I do have so much respect for you and know you to be a very, you know, sort of a very prudent, cautious guy who's very concerned. And so those of us who are concerned and who have given almost everything we can, I did kind of the same thing with my radio career, trying to keep a green show on, you know, when Air America was going into the red all those years. I had you on during that era of eco talk, and I finally realized I was putting my family in financial danger. I was no longer sustainable because I was spending every penny I had, donating my time, paying the network to do a show that I thought would wake people up, and yet it wasn't enough, and it almost, you know, put us under. So at some point, we do have to look out for ourselves, and yet, again, here comes the curse. Once we know what we know, it's kind of hard to find anything else to spend your time doing, even if it doesn't pay the rent and even if it does take you down into the red. So you think with all this, you know, shouting on the part of the planet, Mother Nature screaming at us to pay attention, that environmentalists and climate scientists and politicians who understand these very urgent and complex ecological challenges would be kind of ruling the day, that we'd be listening to you. And yet it's the opposite. We have Tea Partiers, you know, in Congress, to a person, I believe, who don't believe climate change is even real, and they are ruling the public discourse and dominating the media. And of course, this is partly because 95% of all talk shows are, you know, right wing dominated. No exaggeration there. Do you think it's time for a green tea party, Mike? Some of us are talking about that.
Yes, I do. My good friend Evan Goodstein, who's been an organizer on campuses and started a campaign called Focus the Nation in the last few years. Evan's been talking about forming an American Clean Energy Party, party. You know, third parties haven't had a lot of success in this country, and they can cause problems. You know, they can cause more problems than they solve sometimes. And, many people point to Ralph Nader in 2000 as an example of that, although I'm not fully sympathetic with, I think Al Gore lost that race more than Ralph Nader caused him to lose it. But anyway.
Yeah, we had that debate in my household as well.
Yeah.
My friend Ralph Nader caused George Bush to be president, my husband will say, and we'll get into it. We don't do that anymore, thank goodness. But, yeah, one can only wonder if Al Gore had, you know, in fact, won the presidency or did win, if he had taken, you know, office, we might be in a different place. And it still wouldn't be far enough along down the sustainable path. And that's what's really aggravating, frustrating, frightening, that we're, you know, it will take all of us to get into action yesterday, and we're not doing that yet. And every day we're not is a day that we're leading our children, grandchildren, and beyond into, you know, a future with less stable climate, with more, you know, agricultural, you know, disruption. It's just, the great exacerbator, as someone said, climate change, and the problems, you know, we're entering uncharted territory. We don't even know what we are, experimenting with here.
Yeah, well, look, there's lots of reasons to be depressed, and you look at the Tea Party, and you see the deniers, and you see Fox News just repeating. I mean, they live in an evidence-free reality, you know, an evidence-free world. There's no evidence, there are no facts for what they say day after day on global warming. They don't care, and it's hateful, and it's wrong, and it's harmful. However, you know, prior to the Civil Rights Act of 1964 passing. I mean, if you were to have traveled through most of the country, but especially the South and the border states, and listened to talk radio then, and gone into public accommodations, and seen the level of apartheid and the hatred and the division and the legal discrimination and the backward views, the appalling attitudes of whites toward racial integration that existed in 1964, and then with one vote, it was all illegal. We didn't change every human heart. We didn't. That took a little bit longer. But I was born in Tennessee, in Memphis, Tennessee, the city that Martin Luther King was assassinated in. I was born in Memphis in 1962, grew up in Tennessee and Georgia. And, you know, my grandparents and their parents, you know, were from a world that was very different than the world that my parents and I grew up in. In my household, there was no talk of discrimination, and my parents were, you know, completely supportive of integration in the South and equality of on racial issues, and it happened very, very quickly. So in the same way that we hear people talking just maddeningly about global warming's not happening or human beings aren't involved, and we think, God, it's so late and sea level is rising and Greenland ice sheet is disappearing, we're doomed, we're never going to change in time. If you just look at the civil rights issue and how quickly that changed, despite the same hateful, harmful speech that was happening then, you understand that we can overcome this. It's just a matter of events combined with leadership, combined with a grassroots that's ready, when the opportunity comes, and we're going to make change happen.
So it'll take a critical mass of crises. I think we're reaching that critical mess perhaps right now, especially in light of what's happened in Japan. I don't know what your position was on nuclear power before the earthquake and tsunami and nuclear crisis, I can imagine, but if you could sort of just talk about that for a moment, if what's happened has changed anything in your mind.
Well, I am not anti-nuclear. I'm not pro-nuclear, but I'm not anti-nuclear. I think it would be insane for us to decommission the existing fleet of nuclear power plants in America that generate about 20% of America's electricity without generating carbon right now. So I'm not in favor of decommissioning nuclear power plants. I also think it's ludicrous and insane to build new nuclear power plants, not so much because I fear the radiation accidents, although I do fear them, but more because they're just fantastically expensive and they don't make sense economically. Energy efficiency gains, wind power, they all outcompete solar. I mean, you might as well burn $20 bills to turn turbines to create electricity than to build nuclear power plants. So fantastically inexpensive and dangerous. In terms of Japan, I mean, look, nuclear power, I mean, how many people have died directly from the nuclear incident in Japan? I don't think we know right now. I think only two directly, and a lot of people have been exposed and some radiation burns. But the reality is, you take all the nuclear power plants in the world and all the accidents, including Chernobyl, and you add them all up, and then you compare, you know, and you say, okay, this is dangerous. But dangerous compared to what? Compared to coal? Coal kills so many more people every year all over the world just through mining accidents. 3,000 people a year die in coal mines in China. You know, we had 37 die last spring in the United States. Then you have the mercury, you have the asthma, you have the code red smog days, you have the cancer clusters and the sea level rise in extreme weather. So, I mean, coal, nuclear, I'm not a fan of nuclear. I don't think we should build new nuclear, but I do think it's important to understand, as much as we fear and dread nuclear power, it's nowhere close to how we should be feeling and acting on coal. The thing that really amazes me about Japan, though, is there is growing evidence, compelling evidence, that when you rearrange all the water on the planet's surface, and that's what global climate change does. It's just a massive rearrangement of water. This is a water planet. And if you heat the planet, you just rearrange all the water in its different states. You take the frozen ice, the frozen water at the poles, you melt that, redistribute it in the oceans all over the world, raising sea level rise. The heat also transmits more moisture into the atmosphere that then comes back down. You are changing water's heavy, heavy weighted relationship to the surface of the Earth all over the Earth. And as a result, it makes complete sense that you would have the shifting, an increased shift in tectonic plates directly related to the redistributed weight of the most common substance on the planet, which is water. There is growing evidence. In fact, there was a conference a year ago, September, in London on the whole issue of climate change connection to tsunamis and earthquakes. Mm-hmm. Scientists, these paleoclimatologists, right, who go back in time and look at what happened with the climate in the past. And what they did was they found that toward the end of the last ice age, about between 12 and 10,000 years ago, as all that ice was melting all over the world, there actually was an uptick in earthquakes all over the world. And so there is increasing evidence that as you redistribute water, you cause more earthquakes. I believe that's what we're seeing with Haiti, with New Zealand, with Japan. We are going to see more earthquakes. And I believe the evidence is only going to grow stronger, and it may be one more thing that helps us finally understand climate change is bad for us in every possible way. And now we're seeing it even as the ground moves.
I saw someone raise the question of whether the 9.0 quake could have been, a result somehow of climate change, and the answer was no, because, something that strong has to emanate from so deep under the Earth's crust, and, it would be Earth's crust that would be impacted by just the phenomenon you just mentioned. Do you believe that?
Again, a single earthquake is like a single weather event. There's no way to obviously connect it or disconnect it definitively from climate change. But I believe that it's compelling. It's a compelling argument that when you redistribute this much weight, this much water, that there's going to be, a consequence. Again, I would refer listeners, to Google climate change and earthquakes, and you'll see a lot of the emerging evidence on that front. But I think that we've seen a lot of earthquakes. And my colleague Ted Glick at the Chesapeake Climate Action Network did some really good research in the last month showing that there's evidence of a big spike in earthquakes just since 1990. Circumstantial now, probably almost certainly going to definitively confirmed soon by science.
And scientists at the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change are saying we could warm several degrees if we don't do anything by the end of this century, maybe as much as 5. Can you even fathom what that would do if we're seeing this already?
Well, if you look at the, again, unrecognizable weather worldwide, you look at the Greenland ice sheet imploding, the Arctic ice disappearing, just record wildfire in Russia, record flooding in Pakistan, Australia, sea level rise impacts worldwide, on and on and on. You look at all that, and all of that, all that we're already seeing is from 1 degree, 1 degree Fahrenheit of warming since 1900, 1 degree. Now, if you get that much impact from 1 degree Fahrenheit, what's 5 degrees Fahrenheit or 10 degrees going to look like by 2100? I mean, that world, that warming, further warming world of 3 or 4 or 5 degrees Fahrenheit will look nothing like the world we presently inhabit. Nothing.
Mike, we just have a couple minutes left. What are you hopeful about? Because I know you have not given up despite the realities that you're talking about that I completely concur with and so many people tuned in agree with or alarmed about. What is giving you hope? Besides you having a teenage child, and I do too, and so we have to have hope and we have to keep fighting.
I've kind of gave up a while ago trying to figure out if I'm hopeful or pessimistic. All I know is a good friend of mine in South Louisiana who's been fighting to save the wetlands and barrier islands there to prevent future Katrina's, you know, I he's been doing it for 30 years, and I asked him, Wendell Turow, really great Cajun activist. I said, Wendell, how do you do it? How do you keep getting up and writing that next letter to the editor and talking at that next church basement, even though, you know, you're losing that battle? And he said, Mike, a drowning man never stops kicking his legs, you know, and some days that's what gets me, keeps me going, you know, is that what are we going to do, stop kicking our legs? No, we're gonna keep fighting. And I mean, that's kind of a depressing way to describe, I guess, some element of hope. But beyond that, you know, on my best days, I'm just inspired by people who are out there fighting for solutions. And I'll give you one example. Governor Martin O'Malley of Maryland, a Democrat, is just completely tuned into the climate issue. He gets it. He talks about sea level rise wherever he goes. He's now the head of the Democratic Governors Association, may run for president after Obama's second term. This is a guy who completely understands climate change and has been fighting. He just went, we just had an amazing legislative fight in the Maryland General Assembly where we came probably about one or two votes shy of getting a policy that would incentivize massive wind farms off the coast of Maryland. And we're going to come back next year and win. But it was just amazing to see someone at such a senior level in our political system and be so articulate and passionate about climate change and the solutions and the jobs that are going to come for steel workers and the trades unions and supported by environmentalists and the legal women voters and on in campuses all across Maryland. It was just really an amazing thing to be part of that coalition with the governor at the head of it, pushing for an offshore wind power bill. And that's what keeps me going. Real people, real leadership, real solutions.
Mike Tidwell, you keep me going. You're one of the most inspirational individuals I've had the pleasure to, if not meet in person, interview. And even though it is sometimes dismal, the view from here, thank you for keep on kicking, and thank you for what you're doing, because that's all we can do, as you said. And in just a couple minutes, we're going to meet someone who has put together a book called The Tactics of Hope, as he focuses on the sustainability challenge that we've been discussing. He is Wilford Welch. Don't miss it. You're going to be inspired by what he's finding. He has some pretty clear ideas about where we can go from here. Perhaps you can stay on and listen. And, Mike, thanks again, or maybe get back to work. We need you.
That's thank you.
Mike Tidwell, and we thank him for joining us. We'll be right back on the Green Front.